Okay, who's going to feedback from group one? First of all, I'm just going to read out the question again. This is particularly helpful for people on the recording. So it was to share approaches for reducing troublesome mental states, for example, anger, depression, jealousy, or obviously, I encourage you to discuss whatever you felt was important to you. Okay, so group one, who's going to feedback from there?
I can if everybody else is okay with everybody, but if other people want to, because I'm very aware that I talk a lot. I got a thumbs up from Claire.
It looks like you've got the job, so anyway.
Get comfy, people.
Fine.
Initially, we sort of started off by saying, there's so many negative emotions to pick from, and I sort of started explaining that, historically, my family anger has been a major problem, and I manage it differently. But I'm still quite available to boom off the roof if the circumstances are right. So we talked about anger, and then Bernard said something really good about, I think it was like people treating him badly and how he dealt with it. It was just like that. He referred to the people who were treating him badly as they were holding on to delusions. It was their delusions creating that, which I thought was brilliant. And then Claire was talking about sort of doing just simple breathing exercises with anger, just to remove herself from the situation, just take a step back. And I said it's like taking a step to the left of the world. Then we started talking about depression, anxiety. I've suffered from chronic anxiety for years, which I have actually managed to get a hold on through Buddhism and, teaching and therapy. But yeah, Claire was talking, shared a lot of really, really like moving stuff about her journey, and where she's at the moment. And sort of part of it is we accept the whole, it's okay not to be okay. Like we have to accept sometimes that this is
That's right.
how we are, and oh, I can't find my notes now. I think that was it. That's all I wrote down. Oh, here we go. Here we go. There's another page. And then we were talking about what a Buddhist perspective is on depression, and there doesn't seem to be, from what people said. And I must admit, I've not looked much in the way of a positive aspects of depression, if that's. So I don't know if there's any recommended reading or teachings that you can think of to share, like how Buddhist perspective of depression is, because
Right.
then Bernard put in about the purification practice and turning the guilt into regret. And that was good, because that helped me personally to put a real solid aspect on the whole guilt and regret. It gave it me in a real life sort of setting. And then finding joy in the small things. Claire was saying about being in the garden, and Rachel was saying about she was gardening and a robin came and was critiquing. A robin followed her around the garden. So, and I just said it was critiquing where she was putting the spuds. And then we got to fear, and then time ran out.
That's cracking.
Y'all need a brewing an Easter egg now, finished.
That was cracking. It really was. I mean, there are so many good points in there. I can't comment on all of them. Like very much what you said that Bern said about understanding more. That people are just acting out of the delusions. So I think that's hugely important. Also, this idea of accepting that it's okay not to be okay, I think that's extremely important. And it doesn't mean, of course, that we don't think there's room for improvement. I mean, obviously, spiritual practice is all about improving, but that's the first point. It's really, really important. Yeah, that is okay not to be okay. And we're all kind of in that together, really. I mean, we have different strengths and weaknesses, but we all have things that we can work on improving on. And
Because we just stretch it out by punishing ourselves for not feeling okay, by
that's
not being
absolutely
the
right.
little ray of sunshine, and getting all the kids' lunches perfect, and when then we punish
Oh,
ourselves for it, and
absolutely.
it just spirals.
That's great. also, I like the thing of taking joy and stuff. It's so important. Also, in little areas where we manage to improve or we manage to reduce anger. I've worked on anger all my life, and I've definitely made improvements. A bit like you, it's still there as a potential. Yeah. It hasn't gone completely, but it is very important.
For me, it's the right circumstances.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that's got to be the right. You know, what I mean, I pick my battles. That's when somebody asked how I managed it. I said I pick my battles.
But it's really important we do take joy and satisfaction in tiny little improvements, which can still be enormously helpful overall. Well, something we looked at yesterday is that this tendency we have to dwell on our negative side of ourselves and our shortcomings too much. And it's really...
Rachel's Robin. We take joy in Rachel's Robin.
Absolutely. Well, you were going to say something about yourself.
No, it just encourages you to do more. Yes, this was working.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, otherwise, if you try for years and nothing happens, you'd think, what's the point?
No, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Shall we move on to group two now? Who's speaking for group two? Who was group two, Faye? Can you remind me?
I don't think we chose somebody to speak, and I know I didn't take any notes, and I'm not really comfortable actually to do the talking. So,
that's fair enough. Anyone else from group two want to say anything? You don't have to.
Come on, Toral, please.
Is there anything you want to share at all?
I can't remember because we had the break now. My mind is, and we talked about anger and envy and some other stuff. Yeah, I think this point around kind of, I guess, the anger, and I think something came up about seeing like road rage and the how you can't like stop. Road rage is so instant, like you can't kind of assess, okay, why am I angry, whatever, it just comes up like that. It's like a big explosion for me anyways, and I guess, and there was an example of how, but the impact of road rage and how, and somebody saw that and like it was really serious and it was like somebody got really violent, and that kind of helped to remember, okay, you know, like to see the consequences, I guess, or just kind of just help you to step back when you need to. And I think for me, I was I talked about envy and kind of this thing about competing with other people, and our society really encourages that in a way, like you have to compete, you have to achieve, you have to this and that. And I think there's some tactics to kind of that helped me to think through that, to kind of, like you were saying yesterday, this interconnectedness, to really remember that, so that you're not kind of these separate things that are competing, but more that somebody else's success can also be your success. Like you can all kind of have this collective, you know, it doesn't always work, but sometimes it's good to remember that.
And that was beautifully put, Laura.
Yeah.
I hope everybody clocked that. That was really important, what you just said. That was beautifully expressed. Sorry, carry on. Yeah.
I can't remember. Guys, help me out. I don't know. Did I forget something?
Jenna talked about mentioned that we talked about attachment, and Jenna mentioned what she was doing. I don't know if Jenna is here or she wanted to.
Yeah, I'm here.
Would you like to mention what? How are you dealing?
Oh, I'm just basically trying not to hang on to any material object. So if somebody wants something I have, I just give it. Unless obviously I can't give away something I imminently need, like my, you know, entire wardrobe or, you know, but if any of my kids want any of my clothes, it's like, yeah, that's fine. And sometimes I feel the attachment then and think, oh, I really like that. And then it's like, well, yeah, but it's only a thing. And that's helped me a lot with material stuff. You know, I find the random act of kindness movement also very helpful.
Yeah. Thank you. Does anybody else want to say anything? Well, thank you very much. There's some inspiring stuff there. It's interesting with something like road rage, as you say, that often sort of that triggers and happens before we've even caught it. And it's why we have to keep working on this over time with anger. If you identify that as a specific trigger for yourself, it's funny. I mean, at times I've been a horror when our computer's playing up. I don't get road rage. I'm very chilled. Sarah is loads more patient than me in all sorts of ways. I don't, she's a mindset of my partner. But you're a little bit more prone to frustration when you're driving, aren't you? It's interesting. We have different triggers. Going back to something I talked about earlier, though, that's why reflecting as a rate, if you feel that anger is something you particularly want to deal with, you might feel it's something else. It might be jealousy or something, or envy. Just bringing that into your daily practice and reminding yourself of the disadvantages again and again and again does, in my experience, make you more likely to be mindful when it's arising in that situation. But it's a long-term thing that you have to do that, keep working on that. But it does gradually make you more mindful, so that, and you're more wary, really, of the dangers of anger. So when it starts first welling up in your mind, before it's got completely out of hand, and before you're giving people the finger and shouting at them and all the rest of it, you notice it, and then you can spot it and do something about it. But it's very, very much a long-term thing. It's an important one, road rage, because I think it's a big problem in our society, isn't it? It's, many, many years ago, I worked as a policeman in London. And, I mean, the number of assaults I dealt with that had come as a result of road rage-type incidents, often involving the sort of people who otherwise wouldn't have dreamt of going out sort of committing crime or assaulting anybody. You know, it's really quite sad. You know, and I've seen where that can lead. It can be very, very damaging. Even if you shout at somebody or give them the finger, some people will react extremely aggressively back to that. And I remember I've dealt with a few incidents like that as well. People just thinking they're not doing anything and sort of showing some sign of anger. And of course, if the other person is very, very proud and full of lots of negativity and anger, you know, they can react back very strongly. So I suppose that's another reason to reflect on the disadvantages of it. Because mostly you'll get away with it if you just shout at somebody or give them the finger. But once in a while, you won't. And people can be really, really horrid back. I remember one lady who'd been chased all the way down the Holloway Road by somebody in a car, and she'd had to drive into the yard at Holloway Police Station because somebody had reacted so badly. Who was that?
I was sharing that in the group about a true story where somebody actually had road rage and he pulled up in front of the car, he got out and they had a fight and he killed the man. The true story was on, it was a film, he killed him. Yeah. Yeah. And the lady had to go in hiding, the witness, for 23 years, and she's still in hiding now. And that was all because of, it's true, it was on TV, and she can't even see her family or anybody. Because of this road rage, and he was a convicted, he was a gangster who actually done the road rage and killed the other person, and he got life, but she's got her life by not being able to see her family.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, that's what I've seen, the way some people react sometimes. There were two things I want to address before we're going to move on now this session to nurturing positive states of mind and wholesome ones. But there were a couple of things I wanted to address, actually. Did anybody discuss, when you were talking about anger, the idea of whether or not anger is ever good or positive, if it can motivate us to do positive things? That didn't come up. I always mention this because it quite often comes up, this. The idea of righteous anger. I mean, funnily enough, I heard some people discussing this on Radio 4 recently. And a lot of them were justifying anger per se, in that it motivates us to do good and change things in society. And so that is why I think it's always worth addressing this. I think if we check, at the moment, sometimes anger can motivate us to do positive things. I mean, I remember, for instance, when I was reading extinction rates in our country, which is quite shocking, you know, of invertebrate species in our lakes and ponds. That was one of the things that turned me on to the whole Extinction Rebellion cause. And if I'm honest, when I first read it, I felt angry that we're doing this, you know, at such an incredible rate, you know, to our environment and to other beings. So in that sense, anger can kind of motivate us to do good. And to some extent, we have to work with that. And so going back to yesterday, at the moment, we do experience attachment and aversion a lot. And we have to work with these things. But that's never the end point from a Buddhist point of view. Yeah. And what we're trying to move towards is more a state where we're to everything. The last thing we want to do is become passive. Yeah, Buddhism isn't about becoming passive. We still want to do things and take on causes and improve the world where we can. But we're trying as much as we can to do that through a pure motivation of love, compassion, and wisdom. You know, and by wisdom, I mean, so it's in line with that interdependent nature that I talked about yesterday. If it didn't come up, I probably don't need to address that further, but it does quite often come up and people justify anger in itself. And from a Buddhist point of view, we're trying to move beyond anger completely. So that all our motivation is out of love and compassion. It's quite relevant, I think, from the, I mentioned Extinction Rebellion, which I know quite a lot of our friends in Somerset are very involved with that, and other Buddhists are, you know, around the world. One of the things people commented on in the early days of that, particularly those demonstrations in London, was how refreshing it was, that it didn't seem so hate-fueled and anger-driven as a lot of previous similar demonstrations in London. And there were much, much better relations between the protesters and the police interacting and things like that, particularly in those early days of Extinction Rebellion. And I think a lot of people found that very inspiring. And certainly in my view, it made a lot of people sit up and pay attention to that cause who might not have done otherwise. So I think that's a good example of that. I mean, there are lots of examples through history. If you look how somebody like His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, deals with the situation in Tibet and what's happened in Tibet and with the Chinese government. I mean, Gandhi is a wonderful example of that. And these people aren't passive. They're very much doing things and everything they can to, you know, to change the world. But again, they're much more motivated by love and compassion and not by anger. So that's probably enough on that. The other thing is depression. It's interesting that you said that. It's true. It's not as specifically addressed in Buddhist psychology generally as it is in Western psychology, where it's probably the main topic, I think, generally in Western psychology, isn't it, dealing with depression? And it's true that. But it is still addressed, and applying the teachings will still be an enormously helpful in dealing with depression. A lot of the meditations that we've recommended and that I talked about in relation to anger can be helpful with depression. That one we did yesterday on dealing with our precious human life, appreciating our precious human life, is often prescribed as a very good one for depression. But a lot of the same principles, applying things like impermanence, emptiness, love, compassion, selflessness, can still be very, very helpful. However, I was going to talk about this anyway, with regard to depression. I know a lot of people who found meditating in the long run enormously helpful in reducing depression. And I know people personally who've managed to move completely beyond relying on drugs and things like that. But it takes a long time, that, and it takes a lot of patience and practice. It doesn't come instantly. You have to keep working on it. Sometimes for some people, at a given time, meditating is probably the worst thing they can possibly do if they're feeling very, very depressed. It tends to withdraw us inwards and look at ourselves more. And for a lot of people who are dealing with extreme depression, that isn't necessarily the most helpful thing in the short term. Sometimes just getting out into nature and things like that can be a lot more effective in the short term. Another thing I think that can be enormously helpful for people who are depressed, and again, the inclination has to come from them. If people are really extremely depressed, this can be very difficult, but it's to get out into the world, doing voluntary work and stuff like that, and do stuff that's helping others. In one way, it's kind of its own reward. It takes us out of ourselves for a start when you're doing stuff like that, and obviously it can bring a lot more of feeling of being worthwhile and being worthy and being useful and things like that, which can often be a problem, you know, when people are depressed, that they feel powerless and useless and that sort of thing. Also, though, what I found myself, not particularly into dealing with depression, but Sarah and I did quite a lot of voluntary work with the care sector. And one of the things I really appreciate about that is it keys you in to a whole sort of kind side of society automatically if you start doing stuff like that. I think it's very, very easy, particularly if you're on your own quite a lot, if we're mainly influenced, our worldview is mostly influenced by reading the news or by seeing the news, it's very, very easy to get very, very cynical about the world and get a very, very negative perception of the world. There is actually an enormous amount of kindness in the world. And for me, and people have different ways of doing this, some of this will be doing this through your work, some of the through your activities with Dharma centers, which is, it can be a very important side of voluntary work as well. In our case, it's particularly with the care sector. But I think keying into that, I find incredibly inspiring, you know. For me, it's what really gives me comfort. Conviction that love, compassion and wisdom really are at operation in the world. You know, we use the term bodhisattva in Buddhism. So like I say, but there is actually an incredible amount of kindness around, and I think it can be really, really helpful just keying into that. I would now invite, oh, and also you're asking about books. The first ones I'd recommend are those two Lama Yeshe ones that I talked about this morning. Become Your Own Therapist and Make Your Mind an Ocean. Also the Kathleen McDonald book has some quite specific advice about dealing with depression. And as I say, and I really would encourage everybody to have that book. Is there anything anybody else wants to bring up or share on that topic or anything else before we move on?
Can I just reiterate what you're saying about the news? It sounds a bit...
Yeah.
I saw His Holiness, 2012, and one of the things he said was good news doesn't sell. He's like, don't get fixated on the news because the rarity of bad things happening compared to the good things that happen isn't equal. So he said if he did that, then nobody would watch the news. But the other side is, as a nurse, when COVID started last year, we used to have like meetings and stuff as things developed. And one of the things that the matron said to us all was, don't watch the news. Don't watch it because and even today I will say to everybody, whatever you watch, big pinch of salt, because they're not getting it right. They're referring to numbers from eons ago. It's not the truth. It's not consistent. Just, you know, go with your own sense of what's happening. That was one of the things that they said. It's like, don't watch the news because we're hard enough dealing with this firsthand as first responders, rather than, you know, dealing with all that. Because the coverage at first caused a lot of problems, gotta say. So just reiterating that point about the news and that, you know, oh, there's so much more good stuff out there.
Thanks for sharing that, and I agree. And one of the things we've done through COVID is we joined a befriending scheme. So we've been visiting people who are self-isolating, who are vulnerable, and doing shopping for them. And people who've been stuck on their own without any company, watching the news, not just every day, in most cases, 5 or 6 times a day at the moment, endlessly having graphs with red lines on them, put in front of them, showing death rates and stuff like that. It's actually built up an enormous amount of fear and hysteria. And we've actually seen that. And obviously it's important. I mean, and I know they'll justify that they're doing it to make people be careful and obey the lockdown rules. Well, but that kind of fear and hysteria, we've seen it, has become a problem in itself. And people have got, the risk very out of proportion with the effect of the risk to themselves, in my opinion, partly as a result of that, because the news has been so skewed, I think, over the last few months on that, hasn't it? But no, thanks for sharing that, Zoe. I agree very much. I mean, we don't actually read newspapers and we hardly ever watch the news on television, partly because of this. Personally, perhaps that's a bit too much in my case. I get a bit out of touch with what's going on with the world at large sometimes as a result. But
Elizabeth, you've got a question?
Elizabeth, yeah.
No, I just wanted to comment on that. Thank you, Faye. To say that, I found out, I don't know, probably 20 years ago, I mean, the news, the TV was depressing me. So I've been living now without it for probably more than 15 years. Neither me or my partner has got the TV, obviously, there's computers, telephones, but because I was really feeling that depression. And is one thing I do not like the social, the media do a lot of harm, I agree. And I'm a bit like you, I'm more like getting out of touch completely. And I know if something happened, somebody would tell me.
Yeah, it's true.
If I want to find out information, I'll go and get it. But definitely, I mean, even when what, I mean, I know it can keep company because I had TV for keeping me company, you know, and sometimes I do that more with radio, but even radio, I bought one last Christmas, not this year last. And I'm not listening to it because each time they put the news on, I have to switch up the sound. So I listen to it in the evening when they don't have the news on. You know, but even commercials, that's less intrusive, but medias are, and for people who are suffering from depression, as you say, isolating and watching, or not. I've got my uncle and auntie in France. There are two of them, and he's watching the news nonstop. It's not going to help to be happy.
No, yeah, I agree. And we have to be wary of letting the media whip up our emotions too much, I think. I mean, it's good to have a free press, so I don't want to just completely slag off the media. I think that's important, and it's a very easy thing to take for granted, I think, if you have it. But it is important. But I agree, I'm quite sceptical about the effect the media has generally on minds and society.
That's my choice. And of course, it's good to have the liberty of speech and opinion. That's key, you know, to human rights. But for example, YouTube, careful with YouTube. And my mum, who's 76, going to 77, have discovered YouTube. So full on with YouTube, and it's great because it helped her a lot and she found a lot of information. But the other day she turned up and she said, oh, there's something who has happened in the world, super important. But I won't mention what it is, just to say that it was completely fake.
That's a thing to be wary of.
And I said, Mum, you need to look at that, you know, and make sure what it comes from, because I double check it with one of my cousin who has relation in that specific country and say, that did not happen. And she came in the evening saying, oh, something really, really bad happened. I said, well, I mean, that's, you know, obviously you arrive just before sleep, somebody telling you that, and you're just like, whoa, you know, it's not going to help to have sweet dreams.
I have this conversation with my father every time I stay with my mum and dad. He watches the news just before he goes to bed every night. But it's up to him, of course. I don't want to sound like I'm judging my dad. Okay, we're going to move on now. I mean, thanks for that, everyone. That was cracking again. We're going to move on now and have a little look at nurturing wholesome mental factors. Can you bring up H5, Faye, just briefly? I'll talk about that. Right, again, this is obviously in the materials that you can all download that have been uploaded. Now, this is one presentation of wholesome mental factors, the things we're actually encouraged to nurture and develop. And just to reiterate what I said yesterday, the basic distinction between unwholesome and wholesome mental factors is unwholesome ones are aligned with ignorance, self-centered attachment and aversion, which are really at the root of them. They lead to problems and difficulties for oneself and others. Wholesome mental factors, conversely, are aligned with wisdom, with compassion and love. And they lead to increased happiness and reduced suffering for oneself and others. Now, there are lots of traditional presentations, actually, of wholesome mental factors. And this isn't actually the traditional one. This is one that was put together by Geshe Tashi, and it's basically contained in that psychology book that I mentioned as part of the Foundation of Buddhist Thought course. it's none of these lists are ever complete. You'll straight away, I suspect everybody will be able to think of other things that they'd probably put in there if we start thinking about, well, you know, the kind of mental states that are helpful and wholesome for ourselves and others. But it's just to give an idea. And the way Geshe Tash is presented this one here is these are actually in descending order of subtlety. And he's related it to the Noble Eightfold Path, which we looked at yesterday. Yeah. Generally, our mind has lots of different levels of subtlety. What we were looking at yesterday, for instance, when we looked at the Four Noble Truths, and we looked at ignorance, attachment, aversion as the three poisons, as I said, the root causes of problems. We're talking at the most subtle level of the mind there, which is ultimately, from a Buddhist point of view, what we're working towards transforming. But those things actually manifest on the surface in grosser levels of the mind. And it's the grosser levels that tend to be dominating our daily experience. There are ways through meditation and practice of getting more in touch with those subtle levels, and that's part important part of the path. But we initially have to address those grosser levels. So when we look, what we've just been talking about, if we're talking about unwholesome things, we have to deal with things like anger and rage first before we can get down to the really, really subtle levels of aversion within our mind. If you've got a lot of anger in your mind, you're never going to get in touch with that more subtle level and be able to transform that. The same applies when we're applying wholesome mental factors. So the way Geshe Tash has presented it here, he's related that first list to right action, right speech, and right livelihood. Right effort is included there, but right effort actually permeates all of them, as I explained yesterday. So there, really, we're talking about physical actions, how our behaviours really manifest on the surface, through our words and through our actions. And we start with that. The second part, the way he's done it there, is related back to the middle part of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right mindfulness and right concentration. And this is when we're really, really trying to develop that calm abiding I talked about yesterday and concentration. And through that, we can get more and more deeply, into our mind. And then the third level, which again, he's related here is to the wisdom part of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right thought and right view. Here we're talking at the most subtle level of the mind. And you will see they look a bit negative the way they're defined there, as the wholesome mental factors of non-attachment, non-hatred and non-ignorance. But of course, they're actually the opposite of the three poisons, which is why they're expressed like that. It means the three poisons have been completely overcome at that level. And that only comes about when the practitioner has, in the way I described yesterday, combined calm abiding and special insight, and actually directly realised emptiness, the empty and interdependent nature of reality. Non-attachment sounds negative. I'm going to talk about this in a minute, though, when I talk about love. But it isn't. It's actually non-attachment that creates the space for real pure love to flourish. Non-attachment to non-hatred. And non-ignorance is actually a synonym for wisdom. It's just defined that way to show that it's overcome the original root affliction of ignorance. And that means that there, it means wisdom of that selfless and interdependent nature that we've talked about a lot. Okay, I'm not going to talk more about that. I mean, again, if you want to go more deeply into this, and I would encourage it, have a read of Geshe Tash's book on Buddhist psychology. It's a big subject, and it's very, very clear in there. And that's where this is drawn from. So you can take that down now, Faye. Thanks. So now we're going to talk about loving kindness. And I'm going to talk a bit about loving compassion. When we're talking about wholesome mental factors, these are really the most important, love, compassion and wisdom. And the path is often divided into two sides, method and wisdom. And the wisdom side is the teachings on emptiness, interdependence, selflessness. The method side includes actually all sorts of things, but it's often just explained in terms of compassion, because it's the most important. And you'll talk about the wisdom and compassion, you know, like that. First thing I think is probably to define exactly what we mean by love in Buddhism. Love is the selfless wish for another being's well-being, or another being's happiness. And that's all it is. It's as simple as that. Compassion which is related to love. The two feed each other and together. It's very, very similar. But that's the selfless wish for another being to be free of suffering. Yeah, but they work together, love and compassion. Very often, love gets mixed up with attachment. And if we honestly check most of our relationships, and say if I talk about a relationship with Sarah, and my wife, there's plenty of love there. There's no question about that, you know, and compassion. I mean, if Sarah hurts herself, I feel it, you know, really quite intensely and deeply. But there's a lot of attachment as well, if I'm honest. And the two get mixed up in our minds, yeah? What we are encouraged to do, and this is very much work in progress, certainly for me, is to gradually work on identifying the two and seeing the difference, and work on nurturing the love and reducing the attachment, yeah? And in my experience, I mean, being in a relationship with somebody is a wonderful kind of laboratory, if you like, for working with that. It's something you have to work with. If Sarah and I are having an argument, it's definitely the attachment that's at the root of the problem, never the love, I would suggest. And you can test this in your own relationships. It's not just if you're in a relationship like that. It applies to our relationships with friends, our relationships with all our family and so on, you know, people we come into contact with from day to day. There are lots of specific practices and meditations in Buddhism to help us with this. And the real grounding that we're encouraged to develop first in order to develop genuine love and compassion is called equanimity. And that's a feeling of more even feeling towards others and also in relation to ourselves, because we're part of this as well. If we're really, really honest, and if we check our relationships, quite often they traditionally use the words friend, enemy or stranger, which I think can be a bit strong. I mean, most of us, personally, I don't have any mortal enemies. I tend not to think of people in terms of enemy like that. But if we're honest and we check, there are some people that we very, very naturally feel more warmly towards than others. Obviously, that's just normal. It's natural. We all feel like that. Quite often, those things can change quite rapidly over the time. And this is one of the things we're encouraged to check and sometimes meditate on from a Buddhist point of view. There are probably people from our past who we caught up as good friends who we perhaps don't feel that fondly about now for one reason or another, because of things we've done or the way they made us feel about ourselves and so on. Conversely, there are people who we perhaps didn't really get on very well at all at one time, but we now feel very, very warmly towards. And we can see this in life. These kind of feelings are very, very changeable. Yeah. Reflecting on that and tying that in with impermanence is a good way over time of gradually evening out our feelings towards others. And the idea, it's not, I mean, quite clearly, with all of us, some people are more important to us than others. We're more important to them. We can affect some people's feelings more than others. I mean, people in our family, for instance, more than we can complete strangers. So you don't lose sight of that. I mean, that's important. But it's basically to reach a point where we acknowledge that everybody has an equal right to happiness. Something the Dalai Lama says all the time, how all sentient beings deserve happiness, but that they're not necessarily achieving it due to ignorance and all the other afflictions and delusions, and they're not. And that, in that sense, we're all equal. Yeah, that from a Buddhist point of view, that is the situation of every unenlightened sentient being, and we're all equal like that. And that is something, as I say, that we're encouraged to meditate on and reflect on, and of course, really importantly, to try and put it into practice in our daily lives, and be aware of attachment and aversion as they're arising, that we're getting too drawn towards some people at the expense of others, maybe, and perhaps being too averse to others. But again, don't expect too much and try and be honest with yourself. Feeling real, genuine, equal love and compassion towards those sentient beings is actually a very, very advanced state of being. I mean, it's one of the qualities of enlightenment, for instance, of course. But for us, it's very, very much work in progress. And it's important now. Again, it comes back to being gentle with yourself and realistic. What I thought we would do now, before we have a discussion on this, is we're going to do a little meditation with Sarah on this. And there's a basic methodology here that we apply a lot when we do meditations on love and compassion in Buddhism. This will also apply to the Tonglen practice, which I'm going to do with us in the last session. You start by actually keying in to a real genuine feeling of love and compassion that you have for a particular person that you naturally feel warmly towards. You really key into that feeling, and you then try and extend it out to incorporate other people, that same feeling. Again, bearing in mind that essential equality that I just explained. It can be quite difficult, this. At first, it can seem quite easy, this practice, and it's very, very easy to sit there with a nice smile on our faces and thinking love to everybody and all sentient beings. It's quite easy to do that at a surface level. But it's really important when they do these in practices, try and ground them in your actual daily life and people you really, really come into contact with in your daily life. Don't make it too ephemeral. And it isn't always that easy. Sometimes it seems it. At other times, particularly if we bring to mind people that we're having real problems with at the moment, it can be quite difficult. And that's okay. It's part of the practice. Don't feel you're failing because that love isn't necessarily arising spontaneously. I often think that's actually a good stage in this practice because you're being real and you're being honest and you're working with your real feelings. If it starts getting uncomfortable, you can pull back a bit and come back again to friends and family. Sometimes you might find somebody's causing you so many problems, it's too difficult. Well, just put it on side for a while. That's okay. That's part of working with the practice. It's also very, very important, and the way we're going to do this with both these practices now and then the one I'll do later, is to bring yourself into this. And we're going to start by thinking about yourself and feeling love and compassion towards yourself. That's really, really important. It can't be overstated, that. We talked about this a bit yesterday, how hard we often are on ourselves and how we often apply harder sort of standards on ourselves than we do on others, on friends and family. If you don't care about yourself and your own well-being, it's very, very difficult. It will be a serious problem in preventing you really, really helping and benefiting others. And obviously, it's extremely important for your own welfare and happiness. So I think I'll now hand over to Sarah and she'll talk us through this. And then we'll have some discussion again at the end of this. Okay.
Okay, so let's get back into nice, comfortable space. Begin to relax your body. Begin to relax your mind. Try and let all thoughts and worries subside. Let's bring our observation onto our breath. Try and get nice and calm. Just become aware and focused in the here and now. Think that you are doing this meditation for the benefit of yourself and others, to generate more positive, loving energy in your mind and send it out to others and to the whole world. You can start by imagining all living beings around you. Your mother is on your left, your father on your right, and other relatives and friends are around and behind you. Imagine in front of you those you dislike or who have hurt you. As Martin said, at this point, it could be useful to think of someone in particular, someone specific you may have a problem with. For any reason. So extending in every direction, right to the horizon, are all other beings. Just try and really feel that they're there. Really try and get a feel for that they're actually there, near you, with you now. All in human form, sitting quietly, just like you. if it's a bit difficult to visualize all beings, that sounds quite tricky. Think of as many as you can comfortably. Stay relaxed, stay calm, don't feel crowded or tense, but imagine that a sense of harmony and peace pervades everyone. Really try and imagine this sense of harmony, this sense of peace, pervading you, pervading everyone around you. Consider how nice it would be for yourself and others if you were able to love all these beings. Contemplate that everyone wants to be happy and to avoid suffering, just as you do. They're all trying to make the best of their lives, even those who are angry and violent through ignorance. Now generate a feeling of love in your heart. You can do this by thinking of someone you love and letting your natural good feelings for this person arise. You might like to imagine your love as a warm, bright light, not physical, but pure, positive energy glowing in your heart. Really try and generate this feeling of love. It's there, it's within us all. Before you can truly love others, you need to love yourself. Loving yourself means accepting yourself as you are, with your present faults and shortcomings, and recognizing you have the potential to free yourself from all your problems. So really wish yourself all the happiness and goodness there is. Imagine that the warm energy in your heart expands until it completely fills your body and mind. If you have a habit of being critical, judgmental, and even angry towards yourself, it will take time to change all this, so you probably will not suddenly feel love for yourself. But if you say to yourself, may I be happy? May I have what I need to feel happy, safe, loved, and satisfied? Then gradually these thoughts and feelings will grow and become genuine. It's enough for now to just think this way and say these words to yourself. You deserve to feel happy. You deserve to feel safe. You deserve to feel loved. You deserve to feel satisfied. Now meditate on love for others. Start with your family and close friends sitting near you. Say in your minds words such as, may you be happy. May you have what you need to feel happy, safe, loved and satisfied. May all your thoughts be positive and all your experiences good. May you be free of problems, sickness and sadness. May your lives be long and peaceful. And may you quickly fulfill your spiritual potential. Imagine the warm, luminous energy radiating from your body, touching them and filling their bodies and minds, bringing them the happiness they wish for. Again, don't worry if you don't actually feel all this love right now. It's enough to say these words and think these thoughts. In time, with practice, the feeling will come. Think next of some people you are not so close to. They could be people you work with, neighbours, fellow shoppers in the supermarket, fellow drivers on the road and so forth. Reflect that they, just like you, want to be happy and deserve to be happy. See if you can feel the wish for them to be happy by thinking, may you be happy. May you have what you need to feel happy, safe, loved and satisfied. May all your thoughts be positive and all your experiences good. May you be free of problems, sickness and sadness. May your lives be long and peaceful. Send the radiant energy of love from your heart to them and imagine that they experience the happiness they wish for. These people may be strangers, but they deserve to feel happy. They deserve to feel safe. They deserve to feel love. They deserve to feel satisfied. And lastly, turn your attention to the people in front of you, those you have a difficulty with. Again, at this point, it could be useful to think of someone in particular you may have a problem with. This makes it more real, more effective. contemplate that they also need and deserve your love. Wish them to be free of the confusion, anger, and self-centeredness that drives them to act the way they do. Really try to want them to find peace of mind, happiness, and finally enlightenment. Think and try to feel sincerely. May you be happy. May you have what you need to feel happy, safe, loved, and satisfied. May all your thoughts be positive and all your experiences good. May you be free of problems, sickness, and sadness. May your lives be long and peaceful. Let's imagine that the radiant energy of love flows from your heart to them and that they experience the happiness they wish for. Continue to send your positive, warm feelings out to all the other people around you. Love is an unlimited spring of good energy, so you shouldn't worry that it will run out. Completely open your heart and imagine your love flowing to every direction, reaching all the beings who are lonely, sick, hungry, confused, oppressed, frustrated, frightened, so many problems. Their suffering disappears and their minds become peaceful, clear, and full of pure happiness. Wish them to have every good experience, from the satisfaction of ordinary needs and desires, all the way to fulfilling their spiritual potential. Concentrate on this feeling of love for a moment. As we draw to the end of this session, think that you definitely have the potential to love everyone, even those who annoy or hurt you, and those you don't even know. Generate a strong wish to work on your own anger, impatience, selfishness, and the other problems that prevent you from having such love. Keeping your mind open and trying to overcome ego's prejudiced attitudes will leave much space in your heart for pure universal love and thus happiness for yourself and others to develop. So finally, let's dedicate the positive energy of this meditation to all beings with the wish that they find happiness and enlightenment.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. Okay, we've got another 10 minutes this session. I thought we'd keep this for a little bit of discussion based on what we've just been doing and talking about. But we're going to do this open, yeah? So bear in mind, this is being recorded, just in fairness to people, so unlike the breakout rooms. We'll be doing one more session in the breakout rooms in the last session today. Firstly, going back to what I was talking about, love and attachment, can people see the difference between the two? And can you identify that in particular relationships? Okay, Susan. You need to...
My confusion is, when you love somebody, the more you start loving somebody, then you would become more attached because that you're loving more. So that's, you know what I mean? So if you're loving somebody, right, and you have like a one-to-one relationship or whatever, family, whatever, you would become more attached, not less attached. Because for me, it's like, if you're loving somebody, to become less attached, it's a bit confusing for me.
Yeah, it's a common confusion, this. Because you seem to be saying if you become more, you love them more, it inevitably means you're more attached to them.
Well, you would become attached because if you've been with somebody for a long, long time and you're with them all the time, you do have that attachment to that person because you feel love and you do feel it.
Yeah, we have to be careful here thinking it's because of the love. It's definitely what happens, Susan. I agree with you completely. Yeah. And from Buddhism, it's a little bit of a danger and it's something we have to look at. And it inevitably leads to problems later, of course. I mean, obviously, particularly if you lose the person, which obviously we've all had friends who's that happened to. And we are encouraged to try and look at it before that happens and to try and be wary of the attachment side. What it isn't true is that if we become less attached, it means we become less loving. Yeah. And that's why it's so important to understand the distinction between the two. And I have to relate this to relationship to Sarah. I mean, we've been together. This will sound terrible. I'm not sure how long it is. How long is it? Maybe 30 years. Yeah. And there's a lot of attachment there as a result of that. My love for Sarah has definitely grown. There's no question of that. I mean, it has over the years. I'd say it's deeper and deeper. I really, really care about Sarah. I really want her to be happy. The compassion side, as I say, if Sarah cuts a finger, I feel it really quite intensely, you know, almost like it's me. That side's all fine, and that's great, and that's encouraged from a Buddhist point of view. The problem is I also rely on Sarah a bit too much sometimes, probably for my own happiness. And there's a danger of being too dependent on Sarah. At times, expecting too much from Sarah as well. And this is why attachment can then become a common source of arguments, you know, with couples. Now, as a Buddhist practitioner, I try to look at that honestly and be wary of it. And absolutely go for it with the love. But whenever I notice it's attachment, I have to just have a little look and think about it. And it probably stops you getting too out of hand, and it does reduce. I've got to be honest, I'm nowhere near the point of not being attached to Sarah, and that's very, very hard. It's work in progress. But I would say, because I've been practicing for 30 years, my attachment to Sarah is less than it was 20 years ago. I'd definitely say that. And we actually have less arguments, partly as a result of that. I don't have unrealistic expectations of Sarah. I don't project just what I want to get out of Sarah onto her and then get disappointed when she's not fulfilling it so much as I used to and things like that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think sometimes if you take attachment and you start becoming a little away from attachment, you can become too far away as well.
Yeah, there's a danger of that. And you have to be wary of that. You have to agree. Yeah. It's not, though. I mean, sometimes we use the word, it's why often they won't use the word detachment, although some teachers do, because that implies a just sort of kind of not caring. And that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about non-attachment. it's good to care, but not to cling. I think that's about the most succinctly way I can put it. You know, attachment, it has this sort of clingy, cloyy side to it. And what we absolutely don't want to do is reach a point of a kind of a emotional neutrality where we don't care about anyone or anything. That's the last thing we're wanting to achieve as Buddhists. And again, we've got to be realistic about this. I mean, it's particularly hard if you've got a partner. But it's why it's also a wonderful chance to apply this stuff. And I would say, because of the Buddhist teachings I've received and the practices I've done, it's helped make our relationship better because it's reduced some of the attachment and certainly some of the grosser levels of it. And hopefully it will prepare us both a little bit better for what's going to come later to one of us, most certainly. Isn't it? And that doesn't mean, obviously, if anything happened to Sarah, I'd be very, very grief-stricken. There's no doubt about that. But it is good to think about that stuff and work on it gradually. It is. But it is a really important point that you've brought up, which is we have to be very, very careful. That doesn't mean we're becoming more neutral, emotionally neutral, and reducing the love. And it's, from a Buddhist point of view, it's the opposite. It's non-attachment actually creates the space for that proper pure love that I've talked about, which is totally selfless. It's just all about the other person. Whereas attachment is about yourself and your own expectations. And it's also a lie to these kind of unreasonable expectations and thinking that a person or a thing or whatever it is we're attached to is too important in terms of its ability to bring us happiness. And in that sense, it's aligned with delusion, you see. Okay, is anybody else want to say anything about that?
I just wanted to add to that because I think, again, society teaches us different things when it comes to love and attachment. Like, it's this thing about expecting things from your partner. So I think we are taught, like, if your partner isn't reaching this standard and doing such and such and whatever, that they're not, you know, like, you've got to, like, this is the standard and this is what love is, and I don't know. So I think we're taught to expect these things, and I've struggled with sometimes, like, this, yeah, what is love and this unconditional love, and then, but then expecting something in return, I guess. Because that's what we're taught, and I don't know if that's wrong or not, to expect something in return. I don't know.
From the point of view of pure love, yes, it is. And we have to be careful words like right and wrong, don't we? It's just to be mindful and work on it. It's very natural. It's very natural, and we all do that. But yes, it is. Pure love, I mean, we can kind of relate this to sort of enlightenment and the Buddha. And the idea with the Buddha is that it's just total pure love for everybody else. There's no personal expectation at all. Now, obviously, that's a long, long way off, and we have to be realistic about that. But it does give an idea of what we're talking about here. And certainly, as I've explained it in our relationship, I can see it, and it has helped me reduce the attachment side, definitely not get rid of it completely. I'd be lying. But as soon as we're starting expecting something in return, then it's the attachment coming in, really. And, of course, the problem with that is we're setting ourselves up for a fall, aren't we? Because we often don't get that thing we expect, do we? And then straight away, problems arise again within the mind. So if we can out, you know, just pure love is kind of its own reward. And it's very, very important. You know, we try and put that into a practice as much as we can. I mean, I used the example yesterday when we were doing our singing with elderly and special needs people. I mean, that's a real good opportunity to be really kind and help others. But I'm modest, being who I am, and I'm not realised. There's a bit of ego in it as well, if I'm really, really honest. I mean, it's here, you walk in and everybody's being so nice to you and lovely. And I used the example yesterday when one lady in particular turned on me and savaged me. And I mean, I was fine about it, and obviously I applied the practice. But there was certainly a little bit of ego in there that didn't like it while it was happening. And that kind of shows out that it's not completely pure. I mean, it's not to feel bad about that. It's just to acknowledge it and think, no, I've still got work to do. I can keep working on this. But thanks. And the other point you're making there, Tora, is I think generally in our culture, love and attachment get completely mixed. And people don't even question if there's any difference. It's why we have to be very careful with words and language. Whereas according to Buddhism, they're very, very clearly defined. Yeah, and there's a difference between love and attachment. But it still acknowledges that generally they get mixed up within the same experience, even in a given person or situation. And it takes a long time just gradually refining out, if you like, the love and letting go of the attachment.
Yeah, I think attachment is actually encouraged in a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hmm. And as the point that Susan made straight away with a lot of people, if you talk about reducing attachment, they think you're automatically talking about with reducing love as well. You know, the good point that Susan made on that. Okay, does anybody else want to say anything on that?
Can I just, sorry, it's actually, it's not about that.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Yeah. No, just before we, like, disappear, I've been doing my sketchy thing as well again, and I've got a little for Rachel.
Oh, wow.
Rachel's <Hi. Robin. laughs>
Thank you.
That should be the logo for this course, shouldn't it?
This is Rachel's Robin. She's Robin's okay, just a bit unhappy where Rachel's put her daffodil bulbs. So yeah, a bit unhappy about that, but yeah, so
you have to share.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
It's just, honestly, I get so amused by this stuff.
Have you got a scanner, Zoe?
I got one on the email and stuff.
When we do an email group, can you share these things?
Yeah, I can send them to y'all.
That'd be really nice. When we share the emails, I think that'd be really, really nice to share.
Yeah, because I've got Toral's thing to send to her as well. But you know, if anybody wants anything drawing or making, or I do have a business, but also I do for nothing. I love drawing. I love it.
Wow,
sending pictures to folk. I do some lovely ones of the Buddha. Sorry,
Thank you very much.
Bit distracting for everybody.
No, that's a lovely way to end the session, I think. We'll have a break now. Do people mind if we come back 5 minutes early?